Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, day two of the Democratic National Convention, and the delegates are fired up in Boston. They want George Bush out. They want John Kerry in. They loved Bill Clinton last night, and they've got a big lineup of party stalwarts on tap tonight. Ted Kennedy, Howard Dean, Dick Gephardt, Tom Daschle, Theresa Hines Kerry, New Face, Barack Obama, and more. But offstage, post-Bill Clinton, post-9/11, post-the-industrial golden age that fed the party's power for decades, Democrats are grappling with exactly how to define their core philosophy now. Tonight on Point, live from the Democratic National Convention, the race for the White House and tracking the soul of the Democratic Party. But first tonight, let's catch the flavor of the convention with sounds from day two of the Democratic Convention around Boston.
So here we are, almost 4 years past our shotgun wedding with this White House. And like we say in Texas, honey, it's time to split the sheets and sign the legal papers.
If the Democrats choose to move toward the Republicans, if that's how they think they're going to get the votes, they will lose. You cannot win the election by being a faux version of the Republican Party. People who like Republicans have a party. It's called the Republican Party. Why would they go with you? Why would they choose hamburger over prime rib?
We can do better than this. We need to send a progressive message and stop being afraid of going to Utah and Idaho and Alabama and Texas. We need to stop being afraid of being Democrats in this country again.
An African American, a Mexican American, and a Native American will have a Senate that proves what we all know. Diversity is our party's hallmark and America's greatest strength.
Our party is fully committed to protecting the fundamental constitutional right to vote for every American and have it fully counted and fairly counted. No more Floridas. Never again.
That was former Texas Governor Ann Richards, filmmaker Michael Moore, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, Senator John Corzine of New Jersey, and Congressman Jesse Jackson Jr. of Illinois. The hand clapping you hear right next to me right now is his proud papa, Jesse Jackson Sr., who sits down with us. Jesse Jackson, welcome. Thanks for being with us on Point.
It's good to be here tonight.
So the house is literally rocking tonight. The music is cranked all the way up on the convention floor and it's pouring over us right here. How is this convention going, Jesse Jackson? Are you hitting the marks you need to mark? Me.
I think so. There's a pendulum between pain and anger and grief and hope. There's a tremendous pain over the 2000 election. 4,500 Jewish citizens voted for Gore and got Buchanan, and they were simply disregarded. Gore was behind 145 votes, 45,000 more to go. They stopped the count. 1 million black votes were disenfranchised, 1 million targeted in year 2000. So we lost the election by virtue of really schemes of a stolen election. That's the pain. The possibility, however, is that Kerry and Emmett represent an emerging hope. And that hope is as big a factor here for tomorrow as the hurt was yesterday.
As you look out on what's going on here tonight, and all this week, there's hope, there's fear. What is more powerful in dealing with the American electorate? I mean, post 9/11, there's reason for fear, so does hope work?
But hope must abound more than fear. Ultimately, you must go forward by hope and not backwards by fear. But the fear of 9/11 is that there is an outside threat. The fear of an election being stolen is an inside threat. We should expect in time, normal times, that American voters' vote will count. We have 50 separate and unequal state elections. Within those states, you have some suburban areas with first-class, second-chance machinery. The poorer you get, the older the machine is, the less likely your vote is to count. And so Florida put a real focus on the issue of count the vote. And between the vote count being a debate and the deal bowl maker of the machine, saying
the electronic machines and computer.
He'll deliver
computer
the votes to Bush, which is suggestive. And now that the idea is floating that you might suspend the election because of a terror attack. Now, that came from a Bush appointee, ratted to by Tom Ridge and by Condoleezza Rice. So the idea of voter tampering on election with some doubt, machine stacked, we deserve an open, free, fair, transparent, honest election. No matter who wins, it should be honest and fair.
There's only a few months left. Are you going to get it? There's not time to remake all of that. Though there's time for scrutiny, there's time for vigilance, but not time to rebuild everything.
And it's difficult because in Florida already they sent out 40-plus thousand letters to people, ex-felons, who were not felons. And about 9 of them were Latino, about 40,000 black. More targeting, you see. A number of people got those notices who had never been arrested. Some arrested, never been jailed. And finally, the court struck it down, and Bush had to withdraw. But the attempts to nullify votes and to disenfranchise continue. So there must be real focus on voter integrity.
Above all, I guess in that case, you need a decisive victory. Are John Kerry and John Edwards the guys to deliver that? Poll out today, Washington Post showing Kerry behind George Bush again.
Well, don't take for granted the idea that a stolen election is something we just live with. We must somehow resist that. And that's the danger of this administration, where Mr. Bush nor Ashcroft, they're not with organized labor, the Congressional Black Caucus, United Methodist Bishops, and he's a United Methodist, NAACP, a closed-door policy to White House and justice. So you really cannot turn to our government. So some are calling for a UN-supervised election, UN observers. We should have it because it is a world election.
Jesse, we've just got you for another minute here. We're talking tonight about the soul of the Democratic Party, where exactly it stands. After Bill Clinton, after 9/11, you've been a two-time candidate for president yourself. You're still very involved at many levels. Here we are, post-industrial age, not the big day for unions anymore. Era of big government is dead, Bill Clinton told us. So what is the heart of the Democratic Party now?
It's how you treat working class people in the last 3 years with a net loss of jobs in every state. In every state, more young black men in jail than there are in college. 4 to 4 million folks have no health insurance that must be addressed. Kids in Appalachia driving 2.5 hours one way to school each day. A coal miner dies every 6 hours from black lung disease. We must address those problems.
Working class or middle class? Bill Clinton seemed to turn decisively toward the middle class. Is that the working class?
Working class become middle class. Of course, in the Appalachia today, if you work and make minimum wage, it's 65% of the poverty level. So you have the working poor. Most poor people are not on welfare. They work every day. And most of them are not black. They're white. They're female, they're young. But whether white, black, or brown, they all matter. And that's the value of having a party like this, where we are driven by this idea of a more perfect union. For all of us fitting under that tent, we must fight for. And what is that except access to education for all children, access to health care for all people? There are a body of values that are kind of bottom up. And that's the Democrats' basic mantra, is bottom up. I hear a lot of talk about liberal versus conservative. I'm tired of running from labels. Pharaoh was a conservative, Moses was a liberal. Herod was a conservative, Jesus was a liberal. Slave masters were conservative, abolitionists were liberals. America's a liberal idea. The idea of give me your tithe, your poor, your huddle masses, America's a liberal idea. We shouldn't run away from America's great mantra. We're not the Grinch. We're the liberal, generous nation. That's what makes us. That's why there's so many immigrants here, because we're liberal. That's what we've been to get the genius from liberals, from immigrants, because we're a liberal idea. And so conservatives must not steal our dream and not steal our joy.
Jesse Jackson on the soul of the Democratic Party, never at a loss for words, and eloquent ones at that. Jesse Jackson, thanks for being with us tonight. Wonderful to have you.
Thank you.
Jesse Jackson, two-time presidential candidate and founder and president of the Rainbow Push Coalition. And he is back into the crowd. Jack Beatty, On Point News analyst, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly, is with me tonight and every night this week. Wow, it is rocking in the background, Jack. And Jesse Jackson has no trouble laying out exactly what the soul of the Democratic Party is as they meet here in Boston. But there are others who are stumbling a little bit on this.
It's true, and people are saying, you know, what can the party be post-Clinton? What can it be in the age of Bush? But tonight, you know, is a night to look back. I mean, two paladins of liberalism are speaking, Ted Kennedy and Dick Gephardt. And Ted Kennedy's relationship with Kerry really is an interesting one. He's been Kerry's proctor, scold, and the inexorable shadow over his career.
And, of course, we're going to hear from him tonight.
Yes, he's going to be speaking tonight. And, you know, his difference, the difference between, say, the old and the new, I think is caught in an anecdote about Kerry and Kennedy. In the Clinton years, they were talking about raising the minimum wage. And Kerry demurred. He said, well, I don't know, maybe we can't afford that. And Kennedy got up and said, no, damn it. If we don't do it, who will? That's what a Democrat does. He raises the minimum wage.
But Ted Kennedy is 72 years old now. And at some levels, his speech tonight is seen as a kind of passing of the torch to the new candidate, John Kerry.
It's definitely a valedictory. There's no question about it. But isn't it interesting that it's his speechwriter, Shrum, who is Kerry's. It's his campaign manager, Mary Beth Cahill, has been running the campaign. It was his intervention in Iowa that helped to get Kerry off the ground. So he's been keeping Kerry afloat. He helped him at the decisive moment, and his people now are pushing Kerry toward the goal line.
Jack, we're going to have more guests on this subject tonight, but let's step back for just a second. The convention now into its second night. A lot of enthusiasm this week. You can hear it everywhere. A ton of enthusiasm for Bill Clinton last night. Very eloquent speech. Yeah. There, the head of the crowd on its feet again and again. Of course, he is the paragon of Democratic centrism and was scorned by some progressive Democrats during his years in office for leading the country to the middle class, away from the poor, and all the rest.
It's true, and he you could say that he did more than any one public figure to delegitimate the old liberalism when he said the era of big government is dead, conceding that there was big government, conceding that maybe we don't need it. That was a delegitimization of what liberalism is, and many people think that that really helped to put the party in a kind of hole. He did it, of course, at the high tide of the Gingrich Revolution.
I want to bring into our conversation now Matt Bai. He's a contributing political writer at the New York Times, has written some great things for the New York Times Sunday Magazine lately, wrote an article just recently about entitled Wiring the Vast Left Wing Conspiracy. Good evening and welcome, Matt Bai. Great to have you with us.
Hey, Tom. It's nice to be back.
Matt, you talked with a lot of people, young, in some cases wealthy progressives, who have looked at the Democratic Party and also Democratic Party leaders and said, we've got a problem here, Houston. What's the problem that's being described?
Well, there's been an increasing talk in Democratic and progressive circles over the last couple of years that what's happened it really stems from going way back to the 1960s, where Republicans in the Barry Goldwater mode began to invest millions and millions of dollars into an infrastructure, an idea infrastructure, think tanks, foundations, media groups, that over the course of a couple of decades made ideas that seemed to be very much out of the mainstream at the time, school vouchers, missile defense, privatization of Social Security, into ideas that are not only widely accepted within the Republican Party, but are actually at the very top of the national
agenda.
This
very conservative ideology now spends more than $300 million annually promoting that agenda, and the Democrats?
The Democrats spend considerably less than that, and the thinking here is that in terms of an intellectual infrastructure, in terms of standing groups, not election to election, but that in a permanent or semi-permanent way, invest continually in thinking up policies and ideas and promoting them, that Democrats have fallen way behind. And a lot of these
Matt, just let me ask you, we'll come to it. But
sure.
Do the Democrats know what is the core idea is that they would or want to promote?
Well, that's the big question, Tom. I mean, that you've hit on the million-dollar question. We can walk out on the floor and ask, and we get a million different responses. The thinking behind this particular group of people who I've written about is that the important thing is to essentially build, to invest in ideas and entrepreneurs. They look at it like venture capital. You find young entrepreneurs who have big ideas, you invest in them, and they will, in fact, spawn, ultimately, the kinds of ideas you're looking for.
We'll come back and look at just that. The applause from the floor is just washing right over everything here tonight. We are bringing you live coverage of the Democratic National Convention and talking tonight about the soul of the Democratic Party, where it is and where it's headed as John Kerry aims for the White House. You can join this conversation tonight. What does the Democratic Party stand for to you today? Who's got the passion, the ideological clarity today, the Democrats or the GOP? And post-Clinton, pre-Kerry,
Does the Democratic Party stand for the poor, the middle class, the nouveau riche? Call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are bringing you live coverage of the Democratic National Convention tonight and talking tonight about the soul of the Democratic Party. You can join our conversation. If Howard Dean stood for, in his words, the Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, what does John Kerry stand for? Can you spell out the philosophy of a John Kerry Democrat? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we are at the convention. You can hear it behind us every minute tonight. Let's duck onto the convention floor for just a minute to hear a little bit of Maya Angelou, who is addressing the gathering.
Do I laud my fellow citizens enough? Then there's what is there in my country which makes me hang my head and avert my eyes when I hear the words, the yet-to-be United States of America. What am I doing about it? Am I like one who sits high and looks low and pretends I see nothing? Or am I relating my disappointment to my leaders and my fellow Americans? As Americans, we should not be afraid to own both the questions and the answers.
Maya Angelou at the podium. We'll hear tonight from Ted Kennedy, from Howard Dean, from Dick Gephardt, from Teresa Hines Carey, from Barack Obama, the Illinois state senator running for the U.S. Senate there, a new face in the Democratic Party, and from Ron Reagan, son of the former president, talking about stem cell research. Right now I'm joined by WBUR reporter Audie Cornish, who's been covering the convention for WBUR and On Point. Audie, you've been talking with delegates today. What do they have to say about Bill Clinton's Stemwinder last night?
Well, they were actually pretty excited about it, and there's definitely a sense of relief, as though they were excited to have someone get out there and be fired up about the party and to make the delineations between the Democratic and Republican parties. Today, Michael Moore, filmmaker, was in town. Howard Dean were in town speaking in Boston, and they made a lot of the issue that there's no real difference, you know, sometimes. And they were pointing a little criticism at saying the party cannot continue to go back to the Clinton-era sort of centrist ideas. But the delegates I talked to said, you know, we need to be inclusive, and to be inclusive, we need to have a more central message. And I don't know if it's just the people I happen to walk up to, but there was definitely a strong attitude of being happy to have the Clintons there to really delineate and really explain that ideology.
And did they have the sense that that's the direction in which the Democratic Party is still moving in 2004?
They did. I asked whether they thought, you know, the primary season with Howard Dean being so anti-war so early in the primary, shifting the discussion, turning the discussion, if that made a difference. And they said, you know, this is really about energizing this base, and the base they're talking about is the base that has more central ideas, and they count that centralness as being more inclusive. That was the language that was being used.
Audie Cornish, we'll catch up with you again tonight. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
WBUR reporter Audie Cornish, fresh off the floor of the Democratic National Convention in Boston. We are talking tonight about the soul of the Democratic Party, where it is and where it's headed as John Kerry aims for the White House. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Jack Beatty, there is that note, and you can understand it. Delegates saying, A, they're happy to have Clinton lay down a big speech at the top of the convention, so they know they've got some oomph here, and I guess by any measure he did that last night, whether you agree with him or not. But also caught up in the spell of that Clintonism that worked well for the Democrats in terms of capturing and recapturing the White House in the 90s.
It did, and Clintonism was an adaptation to the controlling political fact about this party, and that's that 50% of the people don't vote. And people really who don't vote are those who are underneath America, the service workers, the people who get a bum deal in the society. The Democrats are torn. If they shape a program to appeal to these people, they risk alienating the professional class people who flock to the party. On the other hand, if they don't shape a program to appeal to them, they have to play on an electoral field tilted, affluent, and Republican. That's a tough field to play on.
We are at the convention talking with Jack Beatty, our own news analyst, with Matt Bai from the New York Times, and joined now by Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large at the American Prospect. Good evening and welcome to the very boisterous convention hall. Harold Meyerson.
I like my convention halls boisterous. Glad to be here.
It makes them fun. It's great to have you tonight. We just heard Audie Cornish, our reporter who was out today with Michael Moore and Howard Dean, and bringing back their message, which sounds an awful lot like Ralph Nader's, at least as we heard it from Audie just now, that there is not enough difference today between the GOP and the Democratic Party. It's too centrist. Where do you find the soul of the Democratic Party today? Does the party know where its soul is?
The party's been confused on this for some time, and it's confused for a lot of reasons, including that, as Jack Beatty just mentioned, it really has kind of the broadest array of social and economic classes in it of just about any political party in the world. And certainly, beginning in the 60s, it picked up a more affluent, socially liberal constituency, but not really responding to some of the classic New Deal programs. And it has had to choose. And what I thought actually was the brilliance of Bill Clinton's speech last night, and I wrote about this in my column, it will be in the Washington Post tomorrow, mm-hmm. is that Clinton came up with a kind of all-inclusive populism, I thought, last night. He sort of made a point of, as John Edwards has done somewhat in his Two Americas speech, Clinton made a point of not really, you know, demonizing the rich. Indeed, his model rich guy was himself. Mm-hmm. And what he said was that the problem is you've got this guy, George W. Bush, who insists on giving money to folks who don't need it, like me, at the expense of schools and national security and security for harbors and things like that. I mean,
But in what sense was that embracing the rich, except that Bill Clinton himself is now a wealthy man?
No, what I'm saying is he kind of did a dividing line there in which he was shaming Bush's favoritism to the rich, and yet the only villain in this story was Bush. And he had a specific point in mind. I think there are two swing constituencies the Democrats need to win in this election. They're sort of the downscale folks who got deindustrialized and are getting much lower-paying jobs,
yes.
and that's in Ohio and
right,
Michigan
right.
And the swing states. And there are still some upscale moderates who are in play, too. This was a speech, I think, calculated to win both those groups to the Democratic column this fall.
Matt Bai, you listened to Bill Clinton last night. I'm sure you've talked with a lot of Democrats who are worried about where the party is headed long term once the anybody but Bush fever passes. Do you think that the concerned Democrats that you've been talking to will have heard in Bill Clinton's speech a formula that effectively takes the party, the progressive movement, whatever you want to call it, forward?
First of all, a lot of the people who heard Bill Clinton's speech last night have heard that speech before, including myself. He's been honing all the various parts of that speech over a good period of time now. And it
being
works.
Paid very handsomely for delivering.
That's right. And it works beautifully. I mean, he had a line last night that I thought he said, strength and wisdom are not opposing values. And that really got the hall. You know, that really hit the heart, I think, of the people.
And
the
a brilliant word to introduce here, I think, the wisdom
values.
Word.
And values.
Values. But just Jack and I were talking earlier today. When you look at John Kerry, that craggy sort of Rushmore face, there's a kind of intuitive belief that maybe that's wise. It's a word that doesn't exactly attach to George Bush, though there are other words that Americans might like that attach to George Bush or
that's
may not
exactly
like.
Right. That's exactly right. He's building a contrast, and he's doing it expertly. Now, you know, the thing about Bill Clinton, you ask, you know, does he articulate a direction for the party? Bill Clinton instinctively articulates a direction for the party. This is what he brings that probably no other Democratic politician, at least of his generation, if not going back quite a way, brings to the party. He doesn't, in a sense, Harold is right, it's calibrated for certain constituencies, and at the same time, you just kind of know that he didn't actually sit and think that out. There is something instinctively politically shrewd about this man.
Shrewd, but you point out yourself, Matt, that in the 90s and post-Bill Clinton, riding still on the energy and the ideas of his decade, the Republicans have made enormous gains,
right,
historic gains against the Democrats.
And this is the problem. This is the problem of being shrewd, and that essentially, it's fine. Bill, what you saw last night was a microcosm of what happened in the 1990s. Bill Clinton comes, he takes the stage, he blows everyone away, he articulates the message beautifully, and then he leaves. And the question is, what does the party get from it? What do you internalize from it? What message do you have when he is off the stage to go forward? And as I say, last night was really a microcosm, because what the party got from Clintonism was not its greatest promise.
its promise to reevaluate, to modernize, to think creatively, the party got a series of tactical maneuvers. And whether that's Bill Clinton's fault or the party's, it's a complicated question. But the lessons of Clintonism were not well learned, I don't think.
And when that magician of ideas and language, Bill Clinton, steps away from the microphone, it may be more difficult for anybody else to pick up that sort of shrewd, fine line that he's capable of drawing. We're talking tonight about the soul of the Democratic Party. You can hear behind me they are fired up with some literal soul or gospel right now. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What does the Democratic Party stand for to you today? James is calling from Storrs, Connecticut. Hi, James. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. Thank you for taking my call.
Great to have you.
Yes, a couple of points. I've heard reference to what is the soul of the Democratic Party. More important than that is was brought out by former President Carter last night. And it's, what is involved here is not only that, but the soul of the nation. And regarding inclusion, I clearly see the Democratic Party as being a party that is involved with inclusion rather than exclusion. President Bush has made abundantly clear that his policies are geared entirely toward corporations. His policies in the last 3.5 years have drastically increased the power of our corporations. With respect to tax policy, President Bush has always heard to say that he does not believe in tax increases. But anyone.
Okay, James, there's the GOP, and we've got it. But what about the Democrats? What exactly do they stand for?
Well, they stand for a tax policy that is. That involves creating wealth for the poor and for the middle class, not only for the wealthy. And a $500 trillion deficit each year for the last couple of years by Bush is clearly a tax increase because that has to be repaid. These deficits.
James, let us pick that up. And thanks very much for your call, Jack Meadey. How about this? James says the Democrats stand for creating wealth for the poor. Here we are, post-Clinton, in the 2000s. Do you agree? Is that right?
I don't agree. I think the Democrats in economic policy have become a business cycle party. We'll get the business cycle going, and we'll let capitalism take care of itself. Well, of course it does, and then the business cycle goes down, and then people are left out of work. Or the business cycle creates what the market wants, which is low-income service jobs. So I don't think they're really seriously concerned with the poor in that way. Their philosophy is, let's just get that economy revved up, and a rising tide will lift all boats.
Harold Meyerson, Bill Clinton might acknowledge that and say, well, yeah, but the only way you lift all boats is to get the economy going. We're not opposed to that. We want to support, we want to make the business cycle just as glorious as it can be.
They're a mix of Robert Rubin economics, which is what you just articulated. Rubin personified that under Clinton. And still, they are also a party concerned in different nooks and crannies, and more than nooks and crannies, with economic justice. The party isn't defined solely in Washington. There are about 150 municipalities around the United States, for instance, that have living wage ordinances to try to boost the wages of some significant number of working families in those cities. Those are all Democratic city councils and county boards of supervisors that are enacting those. And I think that one of the paradoxes here is that labor, while weaker in the country, is institutionally very strong in the party, and I think what they're hoping for this time out is kind of a better deal, a better working relationship with the President Kerry than they had with the President Clinton.
But Matt Bai, you point out that the Democrats have not only lost enormous ground in the Congress, just unprecedented losses in the last decade, but they're also losing ground at the more local level. State legislatures, 37 were controlled by the Democrats, now it's only 17. The losses are real.
Well, I mean, for decades, just look at governor state houses. For decades, Democrats were the dominant state house party. I don't think, been in the majority of governors in the last decade. I don't want to stake everything on that, but I think that's right. They're closer now than they were a few years ago, but they've been in numbers over the last 10 years, 18, 17, 19 governors at a time, well below the 30 to 35 they had for years. This, again, and you pointed to state legislatures, this is all about the erosion of the party at its most basic and unseen level. Much more important, I think, than congressional majorities to some extent, because that's your bench. I mean, I have nothing. Look, I think Barack Obama is probably a fantastic politician. I think he has a tremendous future, and I don't. I take nothing away from the man.
And we'll hear from him later tonight.
And I met him last night, and I was deeply impressed. But the fact that a guy who's a state senator who is just now running for Senate, who's never been elected to anything...
And now unopposed after the sex scandal in Illinois,
never been
nearly.
Elected to anything statewide, is not just the keynote speaker for tonight, but the shining beacon of hope and the keynote speaker for this entire convention speaks volumes to me about a party that has allowed its base to completely erode in the state.
Let's hear just a little bit from the convention floor where California Representative Mike Honda is at the podium.
Abroad. John Kerry will chart a new course for our country, one that points us towards the values of the American dream, one that returns us to the principles of fairness and strength. When we elect John Kerry as our next president and John Edwards as our next vice president, our country will once again enjoy respect and admiration not just from the world's governments, but of the world's people.
America Mike Honda, Congressman from California, at the microphone right now in the convention hall. So, Matt Bai, what is it then? What's the line that the Democrats you've been talking to, and some very wealthy ones, who want to put together a counter-Republican ideology machine for the Democrats, what is the ideology, the philosophy that they want to put that effort behind?
Well, if you ask them, they'll tell you that it's pragmatic and centrist and mainstream, and they're all fans of Bill Clinton. But in reality, when you get down to talking to a lot of these folks, and I talk to many of them, some on the record, some not, about what it is they believe politics is about and what their agenda is about, it is very much to the left. It is very much about even tax increases. It's old-fashioned liberalism. It is tremendous reliance on multilateralism abroad. It is about restraint and defense, all of which is I don't indict as an ideology, and probably my colleagues here, at least Harold, probably thinks is, you know, exactly perhaps where the party should go.
Would Bill Clinton endorse it if he heard it spelled out
No, I don't think he would. And I don't think they endorse Bill Clinton's president, the values of Bill Clinton's presidency nearly so much as they seem to personally like the man. This is a rift. And what I point out in the story and what I think is relevant here is that the Republican Party, for all of its tremendous success over the last 30 years in building an ideology that was, in a sense, triumphant in its own party, also became a much more extreme and shrill party. It is not the party that it was 30 years ago. I grew up in the Northeast like a lot of folks here, and we had moderate Republicans. That's like, you know, seeing a rhino in the wild now, and that wasn't the case. And that is a direct result of all of this infrastructure, all of this money, this infusion of ideology into the party.
So if the Democrats raise the $100 million, are you saying they're going to become more extreme as well in the opposite direction?
I think that's a distinct possibility, yes.
I've got to take a short break here. Matt Bai, Harold Myers, and Jack Beattie, please stand by. We're talking tonight about the soul of the Democratic Party, where it is and where it's headed as John Kerry aims for the White House. You can hear the sound of the convention rolling on behind us, the delegates flowing through the halls and into the hall here tonight. You can join this conversation. What does the Democratic Party stand for in the era after, as Bill Clinton said, big government? And how would you define tonight the soul of the Democratic Party? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are bringing you live coverage of the Democratic National Convention in Boston and talking tonight about the soul of the Democratic Party. Let's go to the podium once more for just a moment to hear a few words from Reverend Dr. James Forbes, Senior Minister at Riverside Church in New York.
To restore the moral, spiritual, and democratic values upon which our country was built. If we revitalize our commitment to these values, we will experience new life together. If we, like the prodigal son, wake up and come to ourselves, we will be able to love America back to health and wholeness. John Kerry and John Edwards are leaders who can rise to these moral challenges Senator Kerry with his lifetime of service to the common good, and Senator Edwards with his consistent commitment to protecting the most vulnerable among us, can return America to the principles of prophetic justice and her founding ideals. We all know and sing the first stanza of America the Beautiful. Oh, beautiful for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain.
And off it goes, Reverend James Forbes, Senior Minister of Riverside Church in New York. We're talking tonight about the soul of the Democratic Party. Just before we came on air, On Point staff caught up with Senator Bob Graham of Florida, former Democratic presidential candidate on the convention floor. We asked him how he sees the soul of the Democratic Party today.
We should be one America, not two Americas, that we should be an America that provides opportunities for all of our people, that we should be an America which is respected for our values, not just our military strength around the world. Those are important to the future of this country. That's what we stand for. President Bush has violated all those principles, and that we have the responsibility of getting the country back in the right direction.
Senator Bob Graham on the floor of the Democratic National Convention just moments ago. I'm joined tonight by Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large at the American Prospect, by the New York Times' Matt Bai, by our own Jack Beatty, and right now, from Silver Spring, Maryland, by Rui Teixeira, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, senior fellow at the Century Foundation, and co-author with John Judas of The Emerging Democratic Majority. Good evening and welcome, Rui Teixeira.
Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. We are hearing a fair bit tonight about a rift in the Democratic Party that Bill Clinton, in his eloquence is able to skate over. But nevertheless, whether this is a party that's embracing centrism and a post-big government era, or this is a party that really is going to be focused on the poor, on labor issues, and all the rest of it, how do you see what's going on with the soul of the party tonight, Rui?
Actually, I guess I sort of disagree with the premise. I don't think that the way things have evolved in the last couple of years, that we're seeing a replay of the divisions between centrists and populists on some of the issues you mentioned, but rather an evolving consensus about the need to get rid of Bush and the need to not refight the same battles over and over, but instead to concentrate on developing a tougher and smarter party that could take advantage of the fact that most Americans, in fact, agree with most of the Democratic Party's positions. So I guess I sort of reject the premise that there's this reawakening, struggle for the soul of the Democratic Party that everybody's going to get out the long knives about. I don't see that.
Harold Meyerson, pick it up here. You've described a gap, and we've heard it from Matt Bai as well tonight, though you also said Bill Clinton's able to sew it together, but how real?
Well, there's been a gap for some time, as I said, since the 70s or 80s between different classes, different emerging forces in the party. But first of all, Bush is a great unifier. And I think what you're finding
in opposition.
But the Democrats have been in opposition for a long time, and it's only relatively recently that they have started to act in some concert. I mean, the people who I know on the platform committee, for instance, who are coming up with the language on trade, which has been probably one of the most divisive issues in the Democratic Party for a very long time. We're able pretty much to come to a common accord, some movement on both sides. And I think Rui is certainly right that there is majority support for many of the Democratic positions. In a way, you know, this is not to predict a John Kerry victory, but George Bush has given Kerry and the Democrats a gift. He really has sort of abdicated the center of the field, the center of the political spectrum. That enables the Democrats to kind of say, okay, we'll cover the center and we'll cover the left, and it makes their task, I think, a little easier. That is not to say that they necessarily then are never going to win, but in a lot of ways they have more flexibility.
If Bush isn't there, they can claim it as their turf.
Yeah.
Rui, the title of your book, Emerging Democratic Majority. So describe it. If we're looking for where the heart of the Democratic Party is, what's that emerging majority look like to your mind?
Well, the emerging majority, as we described it in the book, is a combination of some of the traditional sort of working class groups and perspectives of the Democratic Party and combining it with these sort of emerging constituencies of professionals and minorities and women, and you get a kind of melding of the traditional economic populism, or at least, you know, standing for the interests of the average person, the middle class, and combining that with a lot of the sort of social issues, social stands, perspectives that reflect the way the country is evolving toward a post-industrial society and a more liberal culture, if you will. So the Democrats have become identified both, you know, continue to stand for defending the interests of the little guy, but they also have absorbed all these new constituencies and movements that arose in the 1960s and that are still with us today. Movements for tolerance, civil rights, to protect the environment, for the rights of women, you know, and on and on and on. The Democratic Party is now the party that represents those groups and ideas, and that is also now a part, if you will, of the soul of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party has evolved from a relatively uncomplicated New Deal-style progressivism focused mostly on economic issues. Unions are good. The government has a, you know, the government should help people, and it's become a much more involved, complicated progressivism, but arguably a richer kind of progressivism.
Rui Teixeira, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Sure.
Rui Teixeira, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Let's take some calls. Bill is calling from Fayetteville, North Carolina. Hi, Bill. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
You're quite welcome.
To me, the heart of the American, of the Democratic Party, is a party of hope for the little guy. It's a party that desires to bring to an end two Americas, one for the rich and one for the rest of us. It's a party that will allow Afro-Americans like myself and Hispanics and Native Americans the opportunity to say, there is a party that will allow me to participate to help make this country great. It's a party that will give everyone in America an opportunity to say, I am an American. That's what I love about the Democratic Party. It is a party for everybody, not just the select few.
Bill, do you see that in John Kerry? Do you hear that?
I hear that in John Kerry. I see that being preached by John Edwards. It excites me to know that there is someone that wants to make this country one. Not just for the rich, not just for the poor, not just for the business, not just for the workers, but a country of one. And that's what I see in the Democratic Party. And I tell you, I'm proud to be a Democrat.
Bill, we've got it loud and clear, and we thank you for your call from Fayetteville. Jack Beatty, is it a justified fervor that Bill feels for the party on those grounds?
The party of hope. Well, whether it's a false hope, though, I think is the question. You know, and you can see it in this convention. I could begin to read the list of corporations who have paid for this convention, and it would take me most of the hour. And the party of hope is going to have to say to those corporations, you got to pay your people better. You got to let unions organize. And you can talk about the party of hope, but if you're in hock to these forces, you're not going to deliver on it.
Laura is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to just bring up it seems like the whole theme in the hour has been inclusion for the Democrats, exclusion for the Republicans, and I think that's why it's so difficult to come up with the, quote, soul. I wonder if it almost should be titled, what is the Democratic soundbite? Because we're such a soundbite society. If you're exclusive, you have an easier target, easier audience. You can come up with something that people will listen to and grab onto.
Yeah, yeah.
When you cast a wide net, as Democrats do, you got to please a lot more people, and you can't always come up with that phrase or that catch idea that will really get people to remember who you are and what you stand for.
Laura, it's a fascinating point, and thanks for calling in with it. Thanks very much. Met by, there you hear it, inclusion may be more difficult to define because exclusion by definition sort of limits the field. On the other hand, from Rui Teixeira we hear, and not only Rui, George Bush really has unified the Democratic Party by abandoning the center himself, by becoming ideologically more right-wing. You've said, you've written, don't be fooled, that George Bush, the animosity towards George Bush is not the same as a coherent operating philosophy.
Well, there's a lot to go at there, and I'm going to pick two little pieces here. One, just to answer your question directly, I mean, yes, I wouldn't be fooled. I think George W. Bush has been the uniter and not the divider he always claimed to be, and it's just that he's united all these folks that are a few feet away from us screaming and yelling, and And he has himself to blame for that. And to that extent, he has, as Harold points out, made the Democrats' job not just a little easier, I think a lot easier this year, and actually, I think, just delayed a lot of questions. But I have to say about this issue of inclusion and exclusion, and I hate to be Mr. Negative here. I mean, I love Democrats. I come from, you know, my family's Democrats. My best friends are Democrats. But I
don't want to be ridden out on a rail here tonight.
I got to get out of here alive. But I got to say, I don't accept the premise that the Democratic Party is of inclusion, the Republican Party of exclusion. I've been to rural areas all over this country, places where people go to church, places where people shoot guns, places where people take very seriously small-town values, places where they are reliant on job-based to keep their children at home as opposed to having to go off to some other state. They don't feel included in the Democratic Party. They don't feel included when they turn on the TV tonight. Paul Begala once said to me, he'll probably hate me, Paul Begala, the strategist of the Democratic Party, once said to me, the last acceptable form of bigotry in the Democratic Party is toward rural people. And I think it would go a long way toward solving the Democrats' electoral problems if they came to understand that it's not okay that having come so far in the issue of civil rights, having led the country so dramatically and so successfully, it's not all right to talk about rednecks and hicks and Bible thumpers, that there's a large part of the country out there that needs representation and isn't getting it, isn't feeling included at all.
Harold Meyerson, Matt Bai writes, among those, white males have abandoned the Democratic Party in some considerable number. He says, not so inclusive. What do you say?
Well, it's significant that the Republicans have really manipulated the cultural traditionalism of these folks. That's a huge part of their campaign this year, because they're campaigning mainly to their base, not to the center. But I think a lot of what Matt says is right, and I think part of the reason John Edwards is on the ticket is that one group he played distinctly better with during the primaries was white rural voters. You know, a little John Edwards can do a little work there, but not a hell of a lot, but some.
Somewhat. So, Jack, here we are. It's a complicated picture. It's a patchwork picture, maybe like the country. But at bottom of it, it may come down, Matt's tracking Democrats who want to set up the counterpart of that Republican ideology machine. At the same time, he points out that ideology machine has driven the Republicans further to the right. It may boil down to whether the Democrats are better off honing a razor-edge, sharp, clear philosophy or just being that big, ungainly tent.
Well, they did pretty well as the big, ungainly tent for a long, long time. They had segregationists in it, and they had liberals. And they managed to unify that party. And the differences in the party today are much less than they were in the days of the Democrats' great prosperity. I don't think the span of their coalition is the problem. I think it's in a strange way, it's the personnel. I mean, I'll give you one example. In 1948, the students at Andover Academy voted 2-1 for Dewey over Truman. In 2000, they went 2-1 for Al Gore. That's great that professional and managerial class kids are doing that. But while that's happening, you're getting white males in Tuscumbia County, the poorest county in the country, in Nebraska, going 80% for George W. Bush. The question is, in bringing these new folks into the party, have the Democrats established a new politics of inequality that says nothing poor white guys out in the plains who are getting nothing?
Well, there's a question for this convention and for the weeks and months that are rapidly shortening now toward the presidential election date on November 2nd. It's been a great hour. Harold Meyerson, so wonderful to have you with us tonight.
Pleasure.
Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large at the American Prospect magazine. Matt Bai, love your work always. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
It's really fun talking.
Matt Bai, contributing political writer at the New York Times. Jack, great to have you. Much more convention coverage coming. You can catch up on our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.